Live from around the world, it's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one frontline travel news journalist. Get on the phone now and call 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, the travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
And welcome aboard another edition of Peter Greenberg Worldwide. I hope you're having a wonderful Easter weekend wherever you happen to be. Last week, we were coming to you live from the shores of Alabama, 1 year after the oil spill, to see how they've recovered. They seem to be doing pretty well, as a matter of fact. Since then, of course, you've been living on a few other planes and crossing some a few bodies of water, in fact. Get out your maps, boys and girls. We're at 53 degrees, 31 minutes north, 9 degrees, 16 minutes west. We're coming to you from the County Mayo, otherwise known as the Ashford Castle Hotel, the oldest five-star hotel in Ireland. In fact, it was built, think about this calendar, crazy people, 1228. That's a year, by the way, for those people who are counting. We're taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. You email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. What a week in travel news this has been. Everything from more craziness with the FAA and their controllers. Last time, of course, we talked, we had a controller who fell asleep at the tower. This week, oh yeah, we had a controller who was watching movies. He was actually watching a Samuel Jackson thriller and left his mic on, and the entire air traffic control community, including all the planes in the sky, heard like 3 minutes of the movie. I mean, how crazy is that? At least you should have been watching Airplane. But no, he picked the Samuel Jackson thriller. What I love about that, of course, now the FAA, and then, of course, we had the air traffic controller who allowed the First Lady's plane to become dangerously close to a cargo plane. And, of course, in the wake of this, the FAA has announced changes to controller scheduling. Well, duh. How about changes to the amount of people you hired? You're still 17% low on your staffing levels. Even if you change the scheduling, there'll be guys pulling double shifts and falling asleep at the screen. This is nuts. And then here's the other funny one they did. They said, oh, from now on, the First Lady's plane will be controlled by a supervisor. Wouldn't you think that in the year 2011, the First Lady's plane would already be controlled by a supervisor? And if, does that mean we got a guy controlling my plane named Vern? And he's in the back room reading Playboy? I don't know. But, bottom line is the FAA's got some splaining to do. And some good news for travelers. Actually, you know, I don't often have good news. I got good news. The Department of Transportation was able to do by rulemaking what state legislatures and the United States Congress has never been able to do by passing a law. They've actually put into place, it'll take place this August, new rules. And let me tell you something, it's going to be great for somebody. But at least it'll be fun to watch the show. Remember, in April of 2010, they put in the tarmac delay rule, which basically said that if your plane didn't get back to the gate after being delayed by 3 hours, if it didn't get back before that three-hour mark, the airline would be liable to a fine of up to $27,500 a passenger. Well, a fully loaded 737, that would be about a $4.2 million fine. The airlines, of course, whined and complained that this would only result in more cancellations and higher fares and blah, 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 blah. How many delays over 3 hours have there been in the last, well, 14 months? Three? How about that? And how much money did the airline save when you think about it because of no fuel burn, no misconnected bags, misconnected passengers, planes out of sequence, crews out of cycle? It was a win-win. Yes, there have been some preemptive cancellations. Every time the airline sees a flake of snow or a drop of rain, they might just cancel the flight. But at least that doesn't mean you're sitting out on the runway for 3 hours until they cancel the flight. I think it's all been a good thing. So what have they done now? They've included the one airline group that had been exempt from this, otherwise known as international carriers. Now, guess what? They now have, I don't know why they gave them an additional hour. This one I don't understand. But starting in August, international carriers have 4 hours to get back to the gate. Maybe they think they need a translator. I don't know. But here comes the best part. checked bag fees. No, they're not going away. Airlines will still charge you in most cases for checking your bags. But here's the deal. If they check your bags and then lose your bags or delay your bags under the new rules, you get your money back. And by the way, that does not alleviate them from the liability of replacing the contents of your bag should they lose them permanently. But the bottom line for this is, at least, and it's an obvious legal situation, if you pay for a service and you don't get it, you deserve your money back. Well, people are going to get their money back. And last but not least, you know, when the airlines decreased their capacity and they started parking planes in the desert, one of the reasons why you notice that almost every flight you're on is full, that means the number of people bumped from flights is growing at a pretty alarming rate. So now, U.S. passengers starting in August can get up to $1,300 when you're forced to give up your seat on an overbooked flight. That's a 63% increase under the rules. And guess what? You do have a right to be treated fairly. You know, an airline reservation is an implied contract. And if the airline bumps you, they're in breach of contract. And therefore, you know, here's the downside to this. So don't think you're going to be like running to the bank with dollars in your pocket. It's $1,300 or in kind. So in about 99% of the cases, you won't see a dollar from the airline. What you'll see is a voucher with a dollar value that you can use on another flight. Still, $1,300 is a whole lot better than $200. And that's happening now. So that's a very, very, very good thing. And, of course, I got more things to talk about in the news, but I couldn't let the first segment of the show go without realizing that here we are in Ireland, just a hop, skip, and a jump from Wedding Central, the royal wedding happening next week on April 29th. Where will you be? Did you buy your commemorative plate yet, your snow globe, your tea towel? All of which I think are made in China, but forgetting that, you know, America is still absolutely obsessed with royalty. We'll be talking about that a little later in the show, how the world is preparing for the royal wedding, how they're traveling to it, or maybe not traveling to it. Interesting situation here, and I'll be reporting on that for the CBS Evening News this weekend. I'll be coming to you from London, talking about how many Americans are not coming over for the wedding? How many hotels are not full? How many airline seats are actually empty? You know where I'm going to be for the wedding? I'm going to be in Washington, D.C. at 6 in the morning going to a party at the Ritz-Carlton just because I figured I might as well go see it and somebody better feed me. But normally, I mean, this is different than 1981, a different time of the year. Remember, April 29th is a somewhat awkward date for most Americans to travel on vacation. School isn't out. It's after spring break. It's not summer yet. And how compelling is it to go watch the Brits parade when you can't even get close to seeing it anyway? So most people are realizing, you know what? It's like watching the Rose Parade. I'd much rather watch it on TV than camp out the night before and freeze and not see anything. And that's exactly what so many Americans are doing. They're essentially saying, I'll get up early, keep the pajamas on, brew a cup of tea, make believe I'm there. Anyway, we're not making believe where we are. We're at Ashford Castle, an amazing 350-acre estate, and we'll be back with more of Peter Greenberg Worldwide and our pal Scott McCartney from the Wall Street Journal right after these messages.
The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now, so call us at 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
MedJet Assist. If you're injured or hospitalized while traveling, MedJet Assist will arrange medical transportation directly to the hospital of your choice. Travel safely and be smart. Get MedJet Assist. Take trips, not chances.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
It's 18 minutes after the hour. Peter Greenberg here with you from Ashford Castle, looking out over Lake Corrib, which, unbelievable, like 35 miles in length, about 350, or depending on whose count you believe, up to 365 islands out there on an absolutely stunning day here in Ireland, and taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. Email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, your phone number, your question, or your problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. And as I always do at this time of the show every week, I encourage you to go to our website, PeterGreenberg.com for our comprehensive list of all the aid and relief organizations that are doing all that hard work in Japan and in Haiti and Chile and Western China and New Zealand, all the places that had such terrifying, earthquakes over the last, year and a half, really. Just unbelievable stuff there. They need your help. And if you look at that list, you'll see all the different ways that you can get involved, not just contribute. We're talking about contributing you, not just your money, you. And getting up close and personal in the relief effort. It's the best vacation you can ever do because you get back so much more than you ever give. But I'm telling you, it's an opportunity you should not pass up. And if you've got kids and they're over the age of 10, you bring them as well. We were talking earlier about all the new rules that the Department of Transportation just put into effect. It'll take place, actually, in August. And joining us on the phone, someone who knows all about the rules and regulations and some of the things that should be rules and regulations, our good pal, the travel editor for the Wall Street Journal, Scott McCartney. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Peter. How are you?
Now, listen, I'm over in Ireland. I'm heading over to London after the show. Do you want me to bring you back a commemorative plate for the wedding, or can you live without it?
Yeah, I can probably live without it. My wife brought back commemorative stuff from Charles and Di many, many years ago, but it's all in an attic somewhere.
See, that's the whole point. It's all stored away. But let's talk about what's going on out there, because I talked earlier in the show about the new DOT rules, which I think are very interesting, considering they were able to do by rulemaking what Congress and state legislatures have not been able to do, right?
Well, they were, and I think even more interesting, forcing airlines to do things that, in terms of common sense, businesses should have done a long time ago. I'm not convinced that travelers are going to see a whole lot of benefit out of this. I think adding international airlines to the tarmac delay rule provides more protection. That's probably going to help cut down on some of those really horrendous entrapments aboard planes that we've seen. The baggage rule got a lot of attention, but it only applies to bags that are lost, not bags that are delayed, and it can take weeks for an airline, as you know, to actually declare a bag lost. You go through a huge hassle of fighting with the airline over the value of the contents of the bag. The airline depreciates it, unilaterally decides how much your suit was worth on the day it was lost, not what it cost to replace it. And at the end of all that process, the $25 bag fee is kind of the least of your worries. But as a matter of principle, airlines should have been refunding it to begin with.
Well, I still think it raises a legal question that if you contract for a service and you don't get it, you're entitled to a refund immediately.
Yeah, but the problem is the airline says, okay, you didn't get the bag; it was lost. So therefore. Or the government says, therefore, you have to refund it. Now, the airline says if the bag gets to you 4 days later or a week after you get home from your cruise or whatever it might be, you still ended up getting the airline delivered the bag at some point to you. And so from a legal standpoint, the airline says, hey, we didn't guarantee that it was going to be on the same flight with you. We got it to you eventually.
And yet, isn't it interesting that they used to say after 9/11 that if your bag wasn't on the flight you were on, they would take the bags off? They were doing positive matching of bags to passengers. I don't think they're doing that anymore.
No, because they can screen the bags. So if you run the bag through the bomb detection machine, which is happening all over now, then you don't really care if it's what passenger it's attached to.
I'm telling you, there's just no common sense anymore. Now, speaking of no common sense, you did a great story this week in the Wall Street Journal about airfare bait and switch in terms of how, you go online to find a fare and you see that something that you like, and when you click to buy it, it's suddenly not available.
Yeah, this has been a problem that people have complained about for years, and I think what attracted me now about it was I think it's happening more and more often. The online search engine companies are getting fancier and fancier technology. Some of them are trying to mimic airline pricing systems and inventory systems, and they're, in a sense, guessing at fares, and they're under such pressure to deliver search results so quickly to you. They're using old data, they're using estimates, they're using all kinds of things except actually pinging the airline and seeing what the fare actually is. And so it's not until you click through to actually buy the fare that they confirm what the price is.
The other thing that just happened to me about 2 months ago, which I found truly interesting because it was such a big disparity in fare, was I was trying to get somebody from New York to Washington, D.C. on the Washington shuttle, And each airline that flies that shuttle, I mean, the primary carriers, U.S. Air and Delta, both, and they must have been signaling each other because they had the exact same fare. It was $309 each way. You couldn't buy a cheaper fare if you tried. And then, and I looked at all the fares for all the hours of the day they flew, from 6 in the morning till 9 at night. It was all $309 for both airlines for every single flight. And then I went on Orbitz and checked out the 8 a.m. flight that everybody else told me was $309, and they had it for $53. And I said, I'm buying this right now. And obviously, and I got it. And the point is that obviously they were operating on inventory that the other airlines didn't want them to have.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how that would all work. Eventually, Orbitz has to go through a GDS into the airline inventory system. But sometimes, you know, there are quirks, and when you log on, the airline obviously knows who you are and knows your company, and it may have been in that case that a company contract came into play. I mean, the complexity of this stuff is just enormous.
Which, by the way, forces you, and by the way, I encourage people to be as many comparison shoppers as they can be, and don't just go to the airline website. Go to every single website you can. There's one website, I don't know if you know about it, called onetime.com. You know about this one, Scott?
Actually, I don't, no.
It's like watching the Jerry Lewis tote board at the annual telethon go nuts. OneTime.com will give you 7 different websites on your screen simultaneously with tote boards that are flipping for any flight you want. And it's wild.
Ah, that sounds great. That sounds great. I'm totally with you on comparing lots of different sites. I do think it's important. I think it's Expedia told me that 5% of their fares actually change on people when they search. The other websites wouldn't even disclose what the error rate or. You know, I called it the wait and switch rate would be, but 1 out of 20, that just seemed huge to me, and so I think to some extent you have to do some clicking through to see what the actual price is these days.
Now, last week I was trying to book somebody to Madrid, and I did it online, and what was interesting is I did it online, and it gave me 24 hours to buy it, and you know what? I was in the air, I forgot about it. When I called the airline to book that fare that I thought I had, they said, oh, your fare already canceled. Let's see if we can rebook it. I'm talking to a human being now. They said, look, your fare dropped by $180.
Yeah, it's, you know, this stuff is happening by the microsecond. It's, as you know, airlines load 20-plus different fares for every flight, and then they manage the inventory in what they call buckets, and they'll make the cheapest fare available, and then all of a sudden there will be a couple purchases or connecting flights will affect the capacity on a certain flight. And so they'll bump the price up just by closing out the cheap buckets and moving people into the higher buckets. And it goes the other way, too. And, you know, you may have, by shopping, you may have convinced the airline that there was higher demand for that flight to Madrid. And then when your flight canceled out, the inventory system, all the computer algorithms said, whoops, demand dropped. We better lower that price.
Amazing. It's the world's biggest crapshoot.
Yeah. It really is. I think it's ridiculous in a lot of ways. The complexity makes the consumer crazy. The notion that a ticket to Madrid, you know, can change every couple hours or even seconds. It's a silly way to run the business in many ways. And I think airlines do themselves a disservice by making it so hard to use their own product.
And bottom line is, if worse comes to worse, always talk to a human being. They might actually have inventory the websites don't have. Scott McCartney, travel editor for the Wall Street Journal and the author of the Wall Street Journal Guide to Power Travel, which means just for appearing on this show, Scott, we're getting you a commemorative wedding plate in London.
Excellent.
And tell your wife. We'll be back with more from Ashford Castle in Ireland right after these messages.
To participate in the program and speak with Peter Greenberg, call 1-888-887-3837 or visit petergreenberg.com. The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now.
They take
So call us at 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. Once again, here's your host, Peter Greenberg.
It's 33 minutes after the hour. Hope you're having a wonderful Easter weekend wherever you are. We're coming to you from Ashford Castle in Ireland. I'm looking out here at the lake. Was out early this morning on the Cong River and watching everybody fish. And the air, I have an admission to make, and nobody paid me to say this. I believe it. I think you can judge the world and make very interesting choices based on where you sleep the best. And there are two places where I sleep the best. One is Fire Island in New York, where I've been since I'm 6 months old, and the other place is Ireland. I've never slept better, other than Fire Island, I've slept here, simply because the air is crisp, it's clean, it knocks you out is what it does. It just cleanses you. And not to mention the cuisine. And my next guest knows a little bit about that. She's on TV. She's on radio here. It's Maureen Kamon. Did I get the right name?
You did.
I got it right.
Yes, you did.
And she's the and last night for dinner, I have to tell you, Maureen, I had my appetizer was mussels, and my mains were oysters. And how coincidental that you're the author of two books, Irish Oyster Cuisine and Irish Mussel Cuisine. What a coincidence. I love
Absolutely.
This. But that's really, and I'm going to do it again tonight. I mean, I can't get enough. I mean, when you think about Irish cuisine, it's almost traditionally, as a stereotype, an oxymoron. People think it's just potatoes.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, and a piece of bacon or something.
That's it.
Yeah.
It's come a long way, hasn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely has.
Tell me, I mean, most people actually have the stereotype that it's just, you know, very starchy and potatoes and very heavily cooked meat.
Mm.
Different now.
Totally different now. And thanks to all the great chefs we have in Ireland now, and even one here in Ashford Castle in Stefan. You know, and I mean, I've been working with food all my life. I trained as home economics teacher.
Hey, you went to Cornell.
I went to Cornell for 2 years,
yeah.
One of the best cookery colleges in America. Wow, what a privilege to be there for 2 years. Well, my husband was a postgraduate student, and it was lovely, and I was young, just married, and brought my first baby over from America.
Wow.
And she now lives in Paris.
And you thought Ireland was cold.
I thought Ireland was cold, and I was up to my knees in snow. And snow plows in winter. I never saw that before.
Well, now you did. That's
yeah,
right.
Yes.
But how has the cuisine changed there? We know it has changed.
Yes.
But, I mean, what finally changed it? What finally let people realize that this is a big deal?
Well, what changes was we had lots of visitors. We were able to travel more. You know, the younger people were able to travel. They picked up ideas. We swapped ideas. Other chefs came into our country. We got very sophisticated food-wise, and we really did. And competition is a great thing. And, you know, and of course, with the island we are, for God's sake, if we don't have shellfish and fish... You know, I was born beside a river in Connemara, born and reared there. I had trout and salmon and fresh eel when I was a young child. How delicate is that? And people look at it now as the glamour food of the world.
Exactly.
And, you know, and then my first teaching job was out in the Aran Islands. And I was teaching young fishermen how to look after themselves when they were out on their trawlers at sea for a week or maybe 2 weeks.
How to actually cook the fish they're catching.
How to cook the fish they were getting and how to make lovely fish stews and easy things for themselves, nourishing, and add a few potatoes to it.
Ah, there are the potatoes.
They have to come in.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, they do. Well, I love my potatoes.
Actually, you know what I had last night? I didn't tell you the whole order.
No.
I had the oysters, I had the mussels. And then I had the garlic and cheese potatoes.
Whoa. Good man yourself.
I did.
Oh, how healthy.
That's probably why I slept so well.
And no wonder you look so well today. You look so happy.
I am happy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sad that this is radio, that people can't see what I'm looking at right now. This incredible vista out this window of the lake and the gardens.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually intoxicating.
It's a bit of heaven.
It is.
It really is.
Okay, but beyond the oysters and the mussels, there are different ways to serve them, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm a big half-shell guy because I just like to take them raw and go for it.
That's right.
I don't even use lemon.
It's a real man thing, isn't it?
Yes,
good.
That's right. But other than that, though, you could do them with cheese. You could do them with garlic.
I do them in drop scones. I do them, wrap them in crepes. I do the same thing with my mussels. I've created nearly 70 recipes how to cook oysters. and then how to cook mussels. Do you know? And they're too shellfish, so close to my heart. But oysters, especially Ireland and oysters, we have festivals.
There's a restaurant in Manhattan that I've now grown to love called Flex, and all they serve is mussels.
Yeah.
And they probably have 25 different mussel dishes on their menu,
oh.
And I always order the same one.
Do you?
It comes in this hot skillet. You have to be careful. And it's called mussels gratin.
Okay.
Unbelievable.
Oh, yes. Mussels gratin. Oh, my God. I have to go over and have them.
Yes, you
I
do.
Really will.
That's.
Yes.
I mean, listen, mussels with cheese, I'm done. And,
yes.
You know, you can always do the traditional one with the garlic and the white wine and the cream sauce, but this is going a little bit further than that.
Well, I had fish pie last night with mussels in it.
Okay, fish pie. Explain what's in the fish pie, please.
In the fish pie I had last night was gorgeous. You know, I had salmon, I had smoked fish, I had fresh cod, I had smoked cod, I had prawns. Wow. And, you know, and a lovely wine and cheese sauce.
Unbelievable. Maureen, come on. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Author of the book, Irish Oyster Cuisine, Irish Mussel Cuisine. And trust me, I'm going to actually try to do some of that myself this year.
Yes.
I hope I don't get anybody in trouble.
I hope you're all listening in America and welcome you. Let you all come to Ireland.
You got it. Back with more from Ashford Castle right after this.
Call now to talk to Peter Greenberg at 1-888-887-3837 or email him at peter@petergreenberg.com. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
Travel Guard Insurance. For travel insurance plans for the unexpected, see your travel agent or visit TravelGuard.com for affordable travel insurance protection from Travel Guard.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
43 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here with you from Ashford Castle, which dates back to, get ready for this, 1228. Unbelievable. Let's hear it for the Normans. And joining me now, somebody I think who knows the Normans, one of the best field archaeologists out there, Michael Gibbons. Michael, I have to tell you that when you leave the castle here, the castle itself is pretty amazing, but when you leave the castle and you drive around, it's hard to ignore the history that surrounds you because it's up close and personal. You're seeing the old stone walls, the way they were originally built.
Yeah, you're in a timescape that's going back layers of it, or palimpsest. The earliest sites around here go back between 6,000 and 7,000 years. And in the grounds, you have Druidic stone circles, Neolithic tombs, a whole layered history. And I'm a Gibbons myself, so I'm one of these Normans who came in as robber barons in the 13th century, but very, very quickly Gaelicized.
Well, let's talk about the Druids. Did they come out late at night still?
Not unless you're well fortified. We see less.
You're talking about drunk.
Yeah.
Okay,
well,
just checking. Okay.
Well, since rural electrification came in the 50s, and since electricity poles started marching across the landscape, we see less druids, less fairies, and all sorts of shadowy characters that were very common once, but are not as common now. So, proof that they don't like electricity.
But forgetting mythology, let's talk about reality, because the reality that you see here, even in this castle, the stone walls, the architecture, and the technology behind those walls. I mean, how they were built with no cement.
Yeah, dry stone, it's a feature of this area. We have wall systems quite close to us here going back the earliest planned landscapes under bogs. The bogs around the castle here in the general west of Ireland are like a blanket, a soft blanket of history. As it's been peeled back, ancient walls, houses, entire landscapes are emerging from underneath the bogs.
Well, let's talk about the castle, because I'm looking behind you right here, looking out at this lake, which is so big. You know, it's miles long.
26 miles.
Yes. And, of course, there's the Khan River. But here's a castle that was built in 1228. And destroy the myth for me. Where's the moat?
Well, the moat is the river.
Ah, okay.
And the castle is built to suppress the Gaelic Irish, because this is a Norman castle. So it's a sort of campaign castle on the edge of the frontier, keeping suppressing the Gaelic lords who are pushed west, the O'Flaherty lords, the O'Malleys to the north.
I was told they were known as the ferocious O'Flahertys.
Yeah, God save us from the ferocious O'Flahertys. But we're still knocking about here till the middle of the 18th century when the first travellers came through here when they were still dangerous, but exotic still. Not too dangerous enough to go visit them. So we have a lovely
series. You see, now that sounds like a bad brochure. Dangerous, but exotic.
Well, you had the sort of, the big attraction was in the 18th century, if you're traveling here, to see the last of the wild barbarous Irish in their uncivilized state, but not quite dangerous enough to threaten you. And those were the Joyce and O'Flaherty chiefs who lived immediately west of us here in Joyce country. So I've been doing a lot of work on that late world of Gaelic lords hanging on here against the onslaught of Anglicisation and colonisation.
And does that feud still continue till today?
No, we're sort of, we've gone, no.
You've gotten beyond it.
We've gotten beyond it, thankfully. It took a long while, 750 years, but we're getting there.
When people first come to this region of West Ireland, what's the biggest surprise for them as first-time visitors?
I suppose they think it's flat. People have an idea that the countryside is flat, when the whole west of Ireland is very mountainous, small mountains, like little miniature Alps, lots of lakes, very dramatic landscapes, and very varied. Like, from one corner of the country to the other, it just massively changes. So yeah. I think that's the big thing. There's no Romans here, so all the roads are a bit windy, so you have to watch that.
Yes, so the zoning laws would never approach this in the United States because the houses are so close to the road in many cases, too.
Yeah, well, the roads, the present roads...
They weren't built for cars,
Yeah, they were. They're just borings. Bohor is the Irish for a road. So the little minor roads have been upgraded. We've been spending billions of dollars of European taxpayers' money widening them. So we think they're very wide, actually, on the road, but...
They're not that wide.
They're not that wide.
They are not that wide. I'm sorry. But, okay, the first surprise, they think it's flat, but it's not.
Yeah.
What's the second surprise?
I think the sheer beauty of it hits them very quickly. You know, if you're coming from anywhere other than, you know, the Rocky Mountains or the Alps, you know, it challenges your sort of prejudices or your expectations, and it tends to exceed them in every way. Despite the weather, we've got grey weather at the moment, you know, it's an interesting landscape visually, so it's sort of
okay. I have a certain prejudice. I would take Ireland on a rainy day above a lot of places on a sunny day.
Well, so would I. I've been mapping it a lot of time, but I've worked abroad as well, so I'm not prejudiced enough to think that there aren't other great landscapes around the place. But we've got one of the finest. Nature gifted us some wonderful landscapes.
And yet, just take a look at the historic part about it. As an archaeologist, there's so much that hasn't even been uncovered.
Yeah, I mean, we're still finding sites all the time. And this year I found the 17th century fort, Neolithic tombs, a whole range of monuments across the country.
Michael Givens, a field archaeologist with lots of surprises, of course. But to talk to Michael, you have to be heavily fortified. Is that right? Hey, Michael, thanks again.
Thank you very much.
We really appreciate it. Back with more from Ashford Castle, County Mayo, on the River Cong, right after this.
The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now, so call us at 1-888-88-PETER. That's 1-888-887-3837. To participate in the program and speak with Peter Greenberg, call 1-888-887-3837 or visit petergreenberg.com. Now back to Peter Greenberg Worldwide.
52 minutes after the hour, coming to you from Ashford Castle on 350 acres overlooking Loch Carrib, an amazing body of water that stretches about, 35 miles in length at some points, and over 365 islands. We're taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. You email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. For those people with a sense of history and a sense of culture, one of the flagship cultural events every year, it started in 1978, is the Galway Arts Festival. And an amazing array of performers and artists have been here over the last, 33 years, I suppose. Joining me now, Paul Fahey, the artistic director of the Galway Arts Festival. And when you hear the word festival, I look at Ireland. I mean, okay, I'm prejudiced. I'm sorry, but I look at Ireland as a year-round festival because there's always something going on, especially I think of Ireland as just music all the time.
It sure is, Peter, and very nice to be here. It is, and Galway is very much, I think, home to the festival.
This, right. This is every July you do this.
Every July. This is our 34th season we're about to have in July 11th to the 24th this year. Established in 78, as you said, out of the university in Galway. It was really an amazing time for artistic explosion, I suppose, in Ireland, outside of Dublin. And kind of around that time as well, when the festival was being founded, the first professional theatre company operating outside of Dublin, Druid, who are now, of course, course, are world famous and have won Tony Awards and are celebrated all around the world, currently on tour in America.
But, you know, what's interesting about it is that, and people don't realize this, 175,000 people show up at this thing.
It's incredible, really, given that Galway is a city of approximately 75,000 to 80,000 people only. So it's,
where do you put them?
So it was always a kind of a small place with a very big outlook, and the festival always was very ambitious from the very word go. So it's incredible. We get people from all over the world. 27% of our audiences are international, and of that 27%, our biggest percentage are actually from America. So we have a huge amount of visitors from New York and from the West Coast as well.
I mean, you get people from the Shakespeare companies, to dance companies, to Joni Mitchell.
To Joni Mitchell, one of my all-time heroes.
I saw that on the list. I went, all right, now we're styling.
Does she
come and sing Gaelic folk songs, though?
She's well able to. She's also a very renowned visual artist, so we did a huge exhibition with her.
Yes, she is.
And I've been a huge fan of Joni Mitchell for, you know, decades.
I know. Don't tell her that. It ages all of us. Thank you so much.
But I had been inviting her to come to Galway for many, many, many years, maybe like 15 years. I used to write her every year saying, you know, I'd love to do this, I'd love to do something else, whatever. And about 2 or 3 years ago, I walked around a corner in New York onto Mulberry Street, around the corner from Spring Street, and there was this amazing Joni Mitchell exhibition. So I walked into the gallery, got chatting to the curator, we clicked immediately, and within 15 minutes I was chatting to Joni Mitchell on the phone, and 3 months later she was in Galway. So they're the joyous stories of being an artistic director of an international festival. It makes up for all of the knocks you get sometimes along the way.
And did she have a great time?
Absolutely, absolutely wonderful. Great to have her. And we've had some other great Canadian and U.S. artists as well. We have a great partnership with Steppenwolf in Chicago. John Mahoney, the actor, who I'm sure everybody will know,
from
Frasier. He's our honorary patron. He's been coming to the festival off and on since the year 2000. So he's a huge fan of Galway, which is fantastic. And we've, you know, artists from Stephen Petronio in New York, David Byrne from New York, Harper Street Dance Chicago. So a whole array of American artists come to Galway.
A website, please?
GalwayArtsFestival.com. Great interactive website. Huge amount
Say
of information.
Say it slower, please.
So Galway, spelled G-A-L-W-A-Y, GalwayArtsFestival.com for all of our information.
Forgetting the festival itself, let's just talk about Galway.
Mm-hmm.
What's the biggest surprise people find when they get there?
I think, it's a very beautiful place, and it's situated in a very unique place in Ireland. We're right on the west coast. It's built on a network of waterways. So it's built on canals. It's an amazing river that runs through the city. And then Galway Bay and the Atlantic Ocean, next stop, New York, on our doorstep. So it's really, really beautiful. And I think the fact that people can walk everywhere in Galway, that's one of its great charms. It's a medieval city centre. So, and that also really adds, at festival time, because it's a lovely shape city to frame a festival. So if you had dropped in from Mars not knowing that you were coming to Galway Arts Festival, you cannot walk down through the streets of Galway during the 2 weeks in July. And
you actually have somebody coming from Mars this year to exhibit, don't you?
I'm sure we have.
I just want to make sure we got that under control.
But you walk downtown and you will know there's something of major cultural importance kind of taking place. But also I think that, you know, that it's a very good university city. There's an art college there. There's a film school there. So Galway's always kind of had a young population, and populations kind of, you know, that rotates kind of on a calendar year, and that's given it a great kind of sense of, I suppose, dynamic and great energy, and so it's a great city of learning as well as a great city of culture.
And you still haven't told me where you're going to put all those people.
Well, of course, Galway has an array of places to stay.
Okay, just checking. You know, you're up to 175,000 people, I had to ask.
It's quite phenomenal, as I said, given that, like, you know, the population is doubled on any particular given day, and, you know, to the west of Galway is the beautiful area of Connemara. We're not very far away from in these great grounds of Ashercastle Castle at the moment. So it's a huge sense of attraction, I suppose, for tourists, as well as seeing something cultural. They can go off and explore an amazing landscape.
Again, the festival is from July 11th to the 24th this year.
July 11th, 24th.
With 175,000 of your closest friends.
175,000 of my closest friends. Art from all over the world. Come and play with us.
You got it. Paul Fahey, the artistic director of the Galway Arts Festival. Thanks for joining us. That music means we're out of time for this hour. For those stations leaving us, have a great rest of your Easter weekend and get ready for the big royal wedding. For those stations smart enough to stick around, we got a whole lot more coming from Ashford Castle in County Mayo on the Kong River. Back with more of Peter Greenberg Worldwide right after this.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Visit our website at www.petergreenberg.com. live from around the world, it's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one frontline travel news journalist. Get on the phone now and call 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, the travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
And welcome aboard Peter Greenberg Worldwide. I hope you're having a wonderful Easter weekend wherever you happen to be. Last week, of course, we were coming to you from the shores of the Gulf Coast in Alabama on the one-year anniversary of the oil spill to see how they've recovered, what they're doing, what they still need to be doing. And, of course, then a few other airplane rides later, we find ourselves in this location, 53 degrees, 31 minutes north, 9 degrees, 16 minutes west, also on the water, I might add. We're coming to you from Ashford Castle in along the Kong River in County Mayo. In fact, those stalwarts might actually argue we're straddling Galway and Mayo because the river sort of separates them too. An amazing place, goes back to the year 1228 when it was first built, and 350 acres overlooking this incredible lake, Loch Corrib, that stretches 37 miles. It's amazing. It's just amazing on a gorgeous, gorgeous day in Ireland. Taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. Of course, we'll be going to London tomorrow to do a little bit of reporting on the royal wedding. And then I'm going to do the smart thing. I'm leaving. You couldn't pay me to stick around London this week. And in fact, I may not be alone. There are a lot of empty hotel rooms, a lot of empty airline seats. It may be the most televised event in terms of heavily watched. In fact, I'll certainly be watching on television from Washington, D.C., but I won't be there, and neither will most of you. So it'll be interesting to see how much of a boon this is to the British economy, because let's face it, nobody's better at merchandising weddings or funerals better than the Brits. And they certainly merchandise this. I actually have an order from 10 of my friends. I don't know why, but I've got to bring back these stupid commemorative plates of Kate and William. And then there's tea towels. I'm waiting for them to come up with a commemorative condom. How about that? I'm sure somebody did. But in any case, it's happening this coming Friday, and I'm sure you'll be watching some of it. It just proves our total obsession with royalty, and it might actually leave some monarchists to believe that America's still a colony. I'm not sure, but we're watching the future king somewhere down the line get married this coming Friday the 29th. In any case, lots of other stories to report this week in the news. Whether it's air traffic controllers falling asleep or getting suspended for watching a DVD while on duty, hello. The one that really caught my eye this week, which really, you got to laugh, I think. You know, how many times have you walked into an airport and you've heard a pre-recorded message, the terror alert today is orange? Do you check a color-coded swatch to find out what that means? I wanted to go in there one day and just hijack the, that's a bad word, but take over the PA system at the airport and come up with, the terror code today is chartreuse. Just to see if anybody would notice. Well, guess what? The color-coded terror system is finally being replaced because it was useless. But here's the best part. Our government hard at work. I'm sure they hired consultants at thousands of dollars to come up with a replacement for the color-coded terror alert. And by the way, they've done it. If we had a drum roll, we'd roll it because this is big news. They've gone from the color-coded terror alert system to two other words. Are you ready? Either elevated, sounds like blood pressure, or imminent. Does that mean run for your life? It's coming. It's like a bad Japanese horror movie. Okay, that's what we've done. Now, elevated means there's a credible terrorist threat against the U.S. Well, there's always a credible terrorist threat against the U.S., so that's meaningless. Or imminent, which warns of a credible, specific, and impending. What does that mean, impending? Does that mean it's going to happen? Imminent usually means you got 30 seconds to duck. okay? If you hear imminent, why would you ever be at an airport or stay there any longer than you had to once you heard the word imminent? Is this really helping us? I'm telling you, it's just silly. But you know what? It sure beats orange. Now we just go from elevated to imminent. How pathetic. And of course, for those of you who like to watch YouTube, who can forget the TSA's pat-down of a six-year-old girl that was totally invasive? It's getting out of control right now. I mean, you know, we've heard of date rape. This is gate rape. We've got to stop this. We've got to replace it with basic common sense. The other day, I was flying back from Madrid, and once again, the three stupidest questions ever devised, other than imminent and elevated, for security, and they'll be asking me this when I leave the United Kingdom. They're going to ask me, are you ready? Here it comes. And every one of these questions can be answered by yes, yes, or no. That's the order. They never change the order. You know, if you ever want to learn anything in this world, why would you ever ask a question that could only be answered by yes or no? You learn nothing. You know, if I think you killed somebody and I'm a police investigator, I'm not going to ask you, did you kill that person? Because you're going to say no, and we have nowhere to talk about. I'm going to say things like, what'd you do with the gun? And if you answer that question, then we have something to talk about. Instead, our crack security forces ask the following three questions. And, of course, the answers are always going to be yes, yes, and no. Even if English is not even your fifth language, you can figure this one out. Did you pack the bags yourself?
Yes.
Have they been with you at all times?
Yes.
Did anybody give you anything?
No.
Okay, you're free to go. Now, you can walk up to that person dressed with 800 pounds of Semtex in your jacket, right, with a smoking fuse, and they're still going to ask you the three stupid questions. You know why? Because they're stupid. This isn't security. This is stupidity. And when are they going to figure this out? I mean, Louis Black, the comedian, always cracks me up because he thinks they should replace everybody at the TSA with mimes. It at least would give security theater a little bit more of creativity than the security theater we have now. I'm sorry, but spending our hard-earned taxpayers' dollars to come up with imminent and elevated and still asking the same three stupid questions is just a perpetuation of absurdity. And, you know, now we're coming up on the royal wedding. Everybody's talking about increased security. I'm telling you, right before the royal wedding, they're still going to say to me, did you pack the bags yourself? Had they been with you at all times? Did anybody give you anything? And I'm going to say yes to the third one. They're going to say what? I'm going to say 10 of the most stupid commemorative plates that I have to bring back to the United States because I have 10 idiot friends who think they want one. How about that? Well, at least it's better than bringing back the faux wedding ring that Kate's been wearing, that they're selling, and all those over-the-top hotel packages that nobody's buying. So maybe I'll tell you what I'll do. Maybe I'll just give away the plates of the security guys. I'll just give them to them. They deserve it for asking those kinds of questions. Anyway, when we come back, a lot of stuff coming up, including our good friend Joe Sharkey from the New York Times. Maybe he wants a plate. If he wants one, I can get him one. He just has to answer those three questions. We'll be back with more from Ashford Castle in Ireland right after these messages.
The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now, so call us at 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
MedJet Assist. If you're injured or hospitalized while traveling, MedJet Assist will arrange medical transportation directly to the hospital of your choice. Travel safely and be smart. Get MedJet Assist. Take trips, not chances.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
It's 18 minutes after the hour. Peter Greenberg here with you, coming to you from Ashford Castle, a 350-acre estate that goes back to the year 1228. But who's counting? Taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. You email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. And as I do every week at this time of the show, I encourage you also to go to our website with the most imaginative name in the world, of course, petergreenberg.com, for one very important reason. That's because we have a comprehensive list of all the aid and relief organizations doing all that hard and essential work in Haiti, in Japan, in Western China, in Chile, and in New Zealand, all those areas that were hit hard by earthquakes in the last year and a half. And let's not just forget Haiti, because that rebuilding effort's going to take at least another 8 years. But the cool thing about the list that you'll see on our website is it gives you all these unknown and, in many cases, unbelievable opportunities to get personally, physically, and actively involved on location in any one of these five locations to help out yourself. A volunteer vacation, if you will, one of the best gifts you can give others, and, of course, in the end, one of the best gifts you can give yourself. Please take a look at that list. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised at how you get to connect the dots in terms of all the different things you get to bring to the party. And if you do this, and if you've got kids over the age of 10, in many cases you can bring them as well, you become the party, and I will celebrate you as well. You know, one of our regulars on the show who always has something interesting to say from wherever we happen to be in the world is our good pal Joe Sharkey from the New York Times. You read his column every Tuesday in the New York Times. And Joe had an interesting piece recently that I thought would be important to discuss, and that is you check out of a hotel, you use your credit card, and then all of a sudden some stuff shows up on your bill that you had no idea about. We're talking again about the growing instance and incidents of credit card fraud. Hey, Joe.
Hey, Peter. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Happy Easter weekend.
Yeah, thank you. Same to you.
So tell me this. What do you have in common with a company called eTunes?
Looney Tunes. Nothing, except the fact that eTunes billed, whatever eTunes is, billed me $23.46. Oddly, the same day I checked out of the Arizona Biltmore Hotel in Phoenix. And, you know, I am in the habit, because this happened to me before with another credit card fraud, I'm in the habit of checking my American Express statement frequently, because I learned the last time it was about a year and a half ago, and there were a series of charges that added up to like $499 each for iTunes. Now iTunes is obviously a legitimate company, but somebody had hacked into the into my credit card and banged all these iTunes charges onto it. What I found out was last year, the hotel credit card hacking, not done by the hotel necessarily, but certainly not done by the hotel, is the leading sector of fraud for credit card hacking. And the reason for that is that hotel point of sale computer systems are famously not up to speed in terms of protections against hackers. So this is where the leading credit card fraud is, in the hotel sector. So I guess the upshot is, when you do travel, and I guess a lot of us do it, but it's important to check your credit card statement and look for those rogue charges that you know that you didn't make.
You know, in that story that you did, Joe, the most amazing thing, and you said the majority of, well, listen to this, 38% of the hacking breaches that were investigated last year occurred in hotel credit card systems. That's staggering.
Right. Yeah. And because you know, unlike you know, if you go into Amazon, for example, that's one great big sophisticated credit card operation. Whereas hotels, the point of, you know, where you enter the information, those are all each individually operated systems at, you know, X number of hotels. Some of which, particularly in the past couple of years, when luxury hotels have not had a lot of money to spend on the back office kind of stuff like that, they've fallen behind, I think. And, you know, in this case, again, it was obvious that this was a fraudulent charge. Now, it's only $23, right? And by the way, when I called American Express Platinum to have this resolved, I was not at all pleased with the immediate response, which was to try to sell me credit card fraud protection. And
You're kidding.
No, I'm like, I think that's what I pay the $450 a year for, right? But their immediate reaction was, and I got this resolved fine after a couple of more calls, but their immediate reaction was, well, the merchant has said that this is a valid charge. And I said, well, you know, check out the merchant. This is obviously, you know, all you have to do is Google this merchant and you find out, you know, this is
But Joe, this is interesting, and I want everybody to listen to this, because when a credit card company wants to sell you what they call credit card fraud protection, It's gilding the lily. Under the federal credit law, as long as you report the loss or the fraud within, you know, a certain amount of time, and your maximum liability, are you ready for this, is zero.
Right. That's what I thought.
If you don't report it, your maximum liability, I believe, is $50. So,
yeah, right.
So the point is, why are they selling you fraud protection when you already have that built into the law?
Well, and when they know that I'm unhappy, you know. I mean, maybe send me a letter later on and try to do that, but don't do that in the phone call to resolve the problem, which is obviously not something that I was responsible for. So anyway, that made
all right. So here's my question.
Resolve it. Yeah.
All right, so they did resolve it. How long did it take them to resolve it?
It took three phone calls. Over.
You're kidding. For $23?
I was not going to give up the $23. And I said, look, I said, I don't care what. I said, but one thing I do not want you to do is to eat the $23 just to keep me happy. I said, you must take the $23 away from those people. And they assured me. They said, no, we did. We did. I said, okay. Because keeping me happy is not the issue. The issue is fraud.
Wow.
Anyway.
And you know what? I'm one of those guilty ones, I have to say, Joe, that I don't often look at my statement often enough.
Yeah.
I need to do that because I'm traveling all over the world, and I'm just happy that they still accept my card, you know.
Yeah. No, but you're a perfect example because your statement is very, very complicated, and, you know, it's easy to overlook a little charge. And once they, you know, as I understand it, once these hackers hit once successfully, they're like, oh, bingo, this is an open channel now, and we can, you know, we can sort of very stealthily build up our fraud on this particular credit card, because they want to, first of all, determine that the card will work in the sense of them being able to bang it. And once they do that, they bide their time, and then they hit it again and again, and before you know it, you know, it's real money.
Oh, sure. And the thing about this fraud, which most people don't realize, is when they want to figure out if the card's going to work to begin with, they realize going in that every different card, whether it's American Express, Visa, MasterCard, Discover, you name it, has what they call floor limits. Even if you have no preset spending limit on American Express, you have a purchasing pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And the computer knows that at American Express, and you already have floor limits in different stores and different merchants. And the floor limits can be as low as $25 in certain areas. So the first charge they're going to bang you out for is going to be way under $100 because they don't want to
the weird $23.46.
Exactly, they don't want to go over that limit to see if it works. Once it goes there, then they know they got a home run going.
That's right. That's exactly as I understand it. Yep.
Wow.
So there you go. You know, again, the thing is, you got to check your. You just have to check your statements because apparently the hotel industry at the top, particularly at luxury hotels. Which are now starting to dig out of the recession, they haven't spent the bucks to make sure that these systems that they have are up to date on in terms of hacker protection. And
there's one more thing which I won't call a fraud, mm-hmm. but I will say it's an issue for me, and that is blocking charges. And that
yes.
You know what I'm talking about. When you check into a hotel, and this is especially true for people who have a Visa or MasterCard. It doesn't really necessarily apply too much to American Express. But when you check into a hotel and they ask to see a credit card, you just think they're going to take an imprint of the credit card so they have a record that your card is on file so they can charge you when you check out. That is not what they are doing. They're blocking charges. They're actually swiping your card, and depending on the hotel's policy, they can be charging anywhere from $100 to $300 a night for the number of nights you're there, just in case you go nuts and try to rip off the mini bar.
Yep.
The problem is, if you're using a card with a credit limit, like a Visa or a MasterCard, they can almost max you out without you knowing it. And then you go to buy dinner later on, and your card's denied. So my advice, if you're going to get credit card blocked at a hotel, use an American Express card. And then, of course, you can always check out using Visa or MasterCard. That's my great piece of advice that will get everybody angry at me, but then again, I'm not shy. Joe Sharkey from the New York Times. You see him every Tuesday. Always happy to have him on the show. And just because you're on the show, Joe, even you'll get a commemorative plate from the wedding. How about that? We'll be back with more from Ashford Castle in Ireland right after this.
To participate in the program and speak with Peter Greenberg, call 1-888-887-3837 or visit petergreenberg.com. The The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now. So call us at 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. Once again, here's your host, Peter Greenberg.
It's 33 minutes after the hour. Peter Greenberg coming to you from Ashford Castle. And we are sort of straddling the border between County Mayo and County Galway and taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. And if you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. You email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, your phone number, your question, or your problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. Those of you who know me and have listened to me for years know that I'm a huge fan of independent bookstores. I champion them, it's just so challenging for them to exist these days with all the big chains, and especially bookstores that are local, especially bookstores that sell a particular kind of book or historical books or rare books. I don't have a Kindle. I don't want a Kindle. I want to hold a book in my hand. I want to smell the ink. I want to turn the pages. You want to call me old-fashioned? I will gladly acknowledge that when it comes to that. Well, here in Ireland, there's a bookstore that's been around since 1940. I know that doesn't sound very old, but let's put it in other words. 8 decades they've been selling books. And yet, while they're an independent bookstore, they've actually been online for over 20 years. Hard to believe, because they're not Amazon.com, and it's not just a bookstore of rare and antique books, and of course they're also an art gallery. Joining me now, the co-owner of a bookstore called Kenny's Bookshop, is Tom Kenny. Did I get it right, Tom?
Yeah, absolutely, Peter.
But you know, in a way, I'm sort of sad that you're online, because I really want to go into the store and hold something in my hand. Am I being stupid about that?
No, you can do that too. I mean, it's a retail bookstore as well as an online bookstore, and it always will be, actually, because you're quite right. There's a tactile feel to books. You know, people just want to handle and hold, and the idea of getting into bed with a computer isn't much fun to me, you know. It's in bed that I do all my reading, for example.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I get in bed with my BlackBerry, but if I want to read, it ain't going to be on the BlackBerry.
No.
It's going to be a book.
No, absolutely, yeah. And it's, you know, it's amazing. One of the great writers that came from this country in the last century, Brendan Behan,
sure,
he was a great regular in our bookstore. Unfortunately, he didn't drive, so when he came to Galway, he always came by bus or by train. And the problem with that was that between us and the station, there was a pub that was quite Republican.
Uh-oh.
So by the time he got to us, he was what you might call Magalior in Irish, slightly wobbly and everything. And
so you sold a lot of books. You took advantage.
Well, no. On the contrary, he would say to my mother, there's only two places in Galway I can't pass, and that's the Old Malt Pub and Kenny's Bookshop. And my mother would say, well, would you please come to us first the next time? But even though he was kind of wobbly and shaky, the moment he took a book off the shelf, you knew that this was a serious bibliophile, that this was a bookman, a man who loved and respected books. And you will know those people the moment they walk into a bookshop anyway. So we're still, being online, it's kind of like going into a bakery shop without being able to smell the cakes.
Thank you.
In a sense.
Yes.
But, so we tried to create an online site that is as near as possible to the experience of actually coming into a bookshop. And I think it's very important to do that.
And yet the type of books that you're selling are a little bit different.
Yeah, we would be best known, I suppose, over the years for selling books of Irish interest. In other words, books by Irish authors in any language are about aspects of Ireland, whether it's football or fiction or drama, or it doesn't really matter to us.
Or travel.
Oh, exactly. Anything. And books of any age as well. So we're up to date with all of the new publications as they're coming out. But at the same time, we would have a huge focus on early antiquarian, out of print, hard to get books, manuscripts, old engravings, maps, all of the things that the kind of trimmings that come with books.
All right. So having said that, what's the most unusual item for sale in your store or online in terms of historical facts or in terms of historical value right now?
Oh, God, there's a big army of them. I mean, literally, and I'm not dodging the question, there are so many
that you have to go online. We would have a lot of, we build up a lot of major collections and archives and things like that for people. So where people might have our colleges, universities, libraries, where they may already have a collection, a lot of what we would be doing would be filling in the gaps, or prompting collections, that kind of thing. They come in all sorts of different, I mean, I remember my brother almost screaming once, and we didn't know what was wrong with him. He had a tiny little book in his hand, and it was Francis Xavier's book on going to China. This was probably the first ever non-Chinese travel book written about China.
Wow.
I can't actually remember the date of it.
And where is that book today?
It's, well, God, it must be 20 years
ago. You sold it.
Well, that's what we're here to do.
You didn't call me.
That's what we're here to do. No, no, but we'll get your number before we leave.
and you sell maps, which I love maps. I'm a cartographer's dream, because I can't get enough of that.
Yeah, well, they're kind of a new art form, if you like, in this country. I don't think people had a real appreciation of what old antiquarian maps
before,
used to be.
Before we run out of time, the website is?
Kennys.ie. That's Kennys.ie. And we have over 5 million books online.
Unbelievable. Tom Kenny, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And I got to go back online, because I'm going to do some damage now.
Good map.
Especially with the maps. We'll be back with more from Ashford Castle on the River Kong right after this.
Call now to talk to Peter Greenberg at 1-888-887-3837 or email him at peter@petergreenberg.com. The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now, so call us at 1-888-88-PETER. That's 1-888-887-3837. Now back to Peter Greenberg Worldwide.
43 minutes after the hour, coming to you from Ashford Castle on the River Kong in Ireland. You know, this place is amazing. 350 acres, and you'll find a golf course here. What a surprise. We're in Ireland, horseback riding. You can go in for bike rides. There's archery. There's tennis. There's clay target shooting, which I love. And then, surprise, surprise, there's falconry. In fact, there's the Ireland School of Falconry. And joining me right now, the director, James Knight. Hey, James.
Hello.
Falconry? How did that happen here? I mean, I understand that falconry, you know, it goes back, what, centuries, really?
Well, yes, thousands of years, 4,000 years. It's an incredibly ancient thing. It came here 11 years ago, when my wife and I decided to come to Ireland with the idea of the falconry school, and we went round.
Which you came from where?
We came from Scotland. We were working in Scotland.
A long way away.
Yeah. And so we were working in Scotland at the time, and then we came over here, and we went round the top half a dozen hotels in Ireland with the idea, and this was the one really with the fantastic location. You know, it's a perfect environment to fly the hawks in.
Exactly. I mean, it reminds you a little bit about Glen Eagles, actually, in Perthshire.
Well, that's where I used to work.
Oh, you're kidding me.
No, that's where
I did not know that.
Oh, right, yeah. I was there for 6 years.
See, when I was there, I went there to the Jackie Stewart School of... Oh, yeah. I had to spell it like, Jackie Stewart, right? That's how he spoke, right? Jackie Stewart School, I mean, because that's the over and under, the clay pigeons.
Yeah.
Oh, the sporting clays. My shoulder ached for weeks, but boy, did I have fun.
Yeah.
So now you're here. You've got 30 birds.
That's it.
Right? And, of course, there's the famous one, Reg.
That's it.
How old is he?
He's 20 years old.
So he came with you?
Yeah. He was the very first bird I ever had.
Wow. Does he know it?
I think he does. He plays up a bit anyway.
Now, explain to me and explain to our listeners what we're really talking about when we're talking about falconry. You're not just watching the birds. You're doing something with them.
Yeah. The whole idea of the falconry school, we're not a zoo. We're not a falconry center. You don't come and just look at the birds. The whole idea is you actually come to the school. We give you a glove. You have the hawk.
You need the glove.
You need the glove. They have sharp talons, absolutely.
Yes.
And then if you're a guest, then you do the flying. And the really lovely thing is that you can walk around the grounds here at Ashford. There's fantastic gardens, and the hawk will follow you through the trees.
Come on, really?
Yeah.
Well, they're following because you got the food. Come on.
Yeah, absolutely. They're following because we have the food.
It's not based on your personality. It's based on what you're carrying in your hand.
Yeah, exactly. So you don't have to be offended. If they don't come back, it's our fault, not yours.
All right, but the actual sport of falconry, what is the actual aim?
The actual sport of falconry, when it started, was a means of hunting. So it was literally a way of catching food for yourself. And there are still people around the world that do falconry for that aim. It got the reputation as sport of kings because then it was very, very popular with emperors and kings. And I'm not great in history, but all sorts of kings took falcons and hawks into battle. So it got that sort of elitist reputation. Whereas, in fact, before the shotgun was invented, it was the only way of catching, you know, a running rabbit or a flying pheasant. So it was really a way of hunting.
And today?
And today, most private falconers would be out trying to catch things with their hawks.
Like
rabbits.
So you're still going after that?
Yeah.
So, okay, absolutely. So here I am at the hotel. I'm at the Ashford Castle.
Right.
I've got the glove on.
Right.
You give me some of my magic food.
Yeah.
Right? I've got the falcons ready to roll.
Right.
They're hawks, actually.
Hawks, exactly.
Right. And then, what do I say? Go get me a rabbit?
You could, but
Well, how about this? Be very, very quiet. I'm going to kill the rabbit. For those people who remember Bugs Bunny.
It's not perfect at Easter, though, is it? The Easter Bunny.
How perfect the timing.
Do
you actually catch rabbits with these things?
No, we don't catch the rabbits here. We couldn't do what we do, a hawk walk, if there were loads of rabbits around the woods. Because, as you say, the hawks only come back to us for a piece of food.
And so if they get the rabbit, they're done.
If they get a rabbit, if they catch something, then.
But in the original Art of Falconry, they got the rabbit and then brought it back,
no,
right?
No, you went to them.
Ah.
Okay, so you're right. It's a
so the return rate for the rabbits was about zero.
How do you mean?
I mean, the rabbits never came back to you.
Have to go to them. Always you have to go to them. Never in a bird of prey's life does it do anything for you. You know, whereas a dog will come
back. I've had dates like that. I can talk for hours about that.
I'm sure.
See, you don't have to say it. The silence, all my male listeners know the silence is deafening on that one.
Okay. Right. Okay.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Okay.
But the bottom line is, okay, you go for a hawk walk, right? So what are they actually fetching for you, or what are they getting for you?
They're not. The pleasure of the hawk walk, and I think the thing that captivates people, is just watching them fly, seeing them almost free. Well, they're free flying. They're flying through the trees, and then coming back to your glove for food.
I love it. James Knight, the director of the Ireland School of Falconry. 30 different hawks, and don't forget Reg.
Thanks
for joining us. And if you give me some food, though, I'll come back. We'll be back with more from Ashford Castle right after this.
The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now, so call us at 1-888-88-PETER. That's 1-888-887-3837. To participate in the program and speak with Peter Greenberg, call 1-888-887-3837 or visit petergreenberg.com. Now back to Peter Greenberg Worldwide.
52 minutes after the hour, coming to you from the beautiful Ashford Castle on a magnificent day here in Ireland. I cannot exaggerate on that one. I'm telling you, I'm looking out the window here and it's difficult to concentrate, but I'm going to do that because we've got Joyce on the phone in Palm Desert. Hey, Joyce.
Oh, Peter, I think you're great. You know, as a travel agent, I think you are so wonderful, and I think everybody should listen to your advice because
Well, thank you, Joyce.
I'm a travel agent, and I think you're great. I just want to say one more suggestion, Peter, because I love Princess Cruises, but you were talking about balconies. A little bit of advice I'm giving. On Princess Cruises, a lot of their windows, balconies, have obstruction. So if anybody's going to book a balcony on a Princess cruise, make sure that they don't have an obstructed window.
You know what? That's a very good suggestion. It's not just Princess cruises. It's any cruise that says they've got a balcony cabin because these days everybody's marketing balconies. And because of the design of individual ships, a lot of times you have a balcony overlooking lifeboats or other structures on the ship. And it's and you're a travel agent, Joyce, so you know this. And because so much of the cruise ship booking is done through travel agents, it's incumbent upon you as a travel agent, as it is among your own customers, to make sure you get down to a definition of terms as to what you're going to be seeing from that window, right?
Could I say something else?
Sure.
Do you know that I booked somebody? I was written up in USA Today, the importance of having a good travel agent. May I say why?
Go ahead.
Well, one of my clients wanted to book a trip to Italy, and they said they wanted this. They looked in the Internet, and they wanted this trip. And I said, no, this isn't good for you. I know it's not good for you. They happen to be good friends of mine. It's really, and I know they could afford Talk, and they could afford Globus. No, we want this. So I said, okay, I'll book it for you. And I did their air and everything. Well, they're on their trip now. They arrived, and I got a phone call at 11:30 at night saying, Joyce, we're in trouble. The company went bankrupt. Help us.
Oh, boy.
And 6 o'clock in the morning, like I always get up to talk to cruise lines, I called a Talk, which I think is great. I mean, you know, Talk.
I know Talk Tours very well, yes.
And I called Globus. Well, fortunately, Globus had the right destination, and the air fitted their air, so I booked it for them. Well, USA. Oh, and then the next day I get a phone call from Globus. Joyce, because you were the first client to call and explain what had happened to your clients, how they were knocked off the tour, we gave it to them free.
Wow. Well, based on that, Joyce, I think we should all book through you from now on. Hey, listen, thank you so much for that call. We really appreciate it. Joyce, that was Joyce calling from Palm Desert. You know, it's interesting. She talked about two things that are important, and that is, and it's one of my biggest pet peeves, it's called brochure language. You know, every third word ends in the letters ST. Everything is best, greatest, most, finest, loveliest. That in itself is a problem. And then every brochure is shot with the widest angle lens known to man, so you think that your cabin's going to be the size of the state of Rhode Island when, in fact, you need a spatula just to get in it. The one thing that Joyce and I didn't talk about, but I will talk about this, is how much time do you spend in your cabin anyway other than showering or sleeping? And the answer is not much. And balconies, to me, are overrated to begin with, because if you look at the size of most balconies, the actual physical size of the balcony itself, not the stateroom, the balcony itself, it's amazing anybody can even sit out there. And yet they love it as a marketing opportunity that people think they can, like, look out at the ocean. You want to look out at the ocean? Book a much cheaper inside cabin. You'll sleep better at night because of the center of gravity. You'll save money. And you wake up in the morning, fresh, happy. You get up there and you walk around the ship and you see as much ocean as you want to see. And you get to enjoy everything on the ship that everybody else gets to enjoy, unless you're on the QM2 and you have the classes of service. Every other ship is different. So bottom line is, balconies in my book literally are overrated entities. There are obviously exceptions to that when you're having the owner's cabin or a huge presidential suite on a ship. But by and large, in my book, balconies are overrated, especially then when people get disappointed when they book a balcony hoping they're going to get the view of all views, and they end up looking at a lifeboat. It's a view, but it's not really what they had in mind. So I appreciate Joyce for her call. The other thing I want to talk about is that 90% of all cruise ship bookings these days are done through travel agents. So, you know, it's not only incumbent upon you, it's incumbent upon your travel agent to be fully disclosing. And there are a lot of travel agents who are essentially cruise-only travel agents because they have preferred supplier relationships with cruise lines. And they should know better than anybody how those ships work because they've been on them, how those ships operate because they've been on them, and how those individual cabins look because they've been in them. So bottom line is, we appreciate Joyce's call. We love the fact that she was able to help her clients out, even when they didn't want to listen to her to begin with. But remember, don't just go by the brochure, and whatever you do, don't just go by the Internet. It's not necessarily wonderfully informational as much as it is transactional, which is what our website, Peter Greenberg, is not. PeterGreenberg.com is informational. We update it every 18 hours, so check it out. It's free. That sound means we're out of time for this hour. For those stations leaving us, have a great rest of your weekend. And for those stations sticking around, we got a whole other hour coming from Ashford Castle, County Mayo in Ireland. We'll be back with more of Peter Greenberg Worldwide right after this.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Visit our website at www.petergreenberg.com. Live from around the world, it's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one frontline travel news journalist. Get on the phone now and call 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, the travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
And welcome back to Peter Greenberg Worldwide, coming to you from Ashford Castle in Ireland on this Easter weekend. Lots of stuff to report on the news. You may have seen the stories about the tornado that ripped into Lambert Field in St. Louis. That airport is closed indefinitely. Now, that's a tough word to say, indefinitely. The mayor is saying that they can probably get back up to speed, or at least 70% by tomorrow and 100% by the middle of next week. But that, of course, presumes that they get the power back on. For the moment, if you're going to St. Louis or trying to get out of St. Louis, your best bet is Springfield. Springfield, Missouri, they have service from American Eagle, but right now most of the people who are trying to get to or from St. Louis from other major hubs are driving all the way to Chicago. It's a mess out there. Even the mayor was stunned at the extent of the damage to that airport. We will stay on top of that, of course, and report back in next week on what's going on. Another thing that is stunning to me in the news, and that's my guest who's coming on the show right now, Jim Carlton from the Wall Street Journal, an amazing story about a proposed piece of legislation in Hawaii that would hold, listen to this, guidebook writers personally and financially liable for deaths or accidents at spots they recommend. Wow. Jim Carlton, help me out here. Is that true?
Hey, Peter, how you doing? I was, you know, reading some of the local press in Hawaii, and there was this item about lawmakers proposing a liability law. And what's happened, for a quick background, the problem has been there's one guidebook in particular called the Ultimate Kauai Guide, written by Andrew Dowdy, and he likes to put in the kind of Kauai revealed, the spots that you don't find out about. And so there's two spots in particular, Queens Bath and Kupu Falls, where they're super dangerous and people have been flocking to them and dying and getting injured. And so lawmakers want to try to put a stop to that.
That seems a little bit far-reaching of a law to hold you personally liable because you recommend a hike and then somebody falls over.
Well, I think what happened is the law was proposed out of a lot of frustration. The local tourism officials had been, kind of pleading with Andrew and some other guidebook authors, please take this out. Queens Bath in particular. I don't know if you've ever been over there in Kauai, but it's
I have.
So it's beautiful, and it's enchanting. And the problem is, it's this natural tidal pool. It's on a volcanic ledge. It's one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen. But it's on the North Shore, and 6 months out of the year, there's monster waves there, and people have been swept to their deaths. There was a tragic case of two sisters-in-law who were walking along that volcanic ledge where probably you were, and they got swept out to sea and died. And so they had actually asked Andrew and some of these other guidebooks, please take this out of your book or at least put in a lot of cautionary language. Andrew, in his defense, says, look, he has more safety language in his books than anybody else. And we tell people, be careful there. Don't even go there in the winter months. But bottom line is, after this failed, the lawmakers decided, well, we're going to make them take it out. We're going to threaten them with suits.
Wow, because there is some precedence for this, at least some legal precedent, if not law precedent in terms of legislation. But in the courts, you mentioned a case that happened back in 1989 where a California couple sued a publisher that did a book called The Encyclopedia of Mushrooms because somebody fell ill and eating wild mushrooms.
Yeah, exactly. They went out and were picking their mushrooms that were recommended supposedly by the book, and almost died. They were seriously ill, and so they decided, well, we're going to sue the publisher. And like so many of these cases, Peter, I mean, there's been this isn't the first time somebody has tried to do legislation like this. And the First Amendment is pretty strong that you can, you know, other than shouting fire in a crowded theater, you can say, you know, pretty much what you want.
Well, in the case of the mushroom case, the court threw it out, right? Basically saying the First Amendment prevailed.
Yeah, they did. In this Hawaii case, so the law was filed in January, or the bill was filed in January. It sailed through the House of Representatives in Hawaii in February. It got amended in the Senate to call for, let's first try a task force. Let's try to get everybody at the table and try to work this out short of the liability threat. So they kind of, it's almost like they put a gun to the heads of the travel writers and cocked the trigger and said, look, if you don't play ball, we're going to fire. And so that actually resulted in, meetings. Andrew Doughty and these other guidebooks have actually met with the tourism people to try to, reach a compromise. And right now that's what they're trying to do.
Wow, because if this law passes the way it was originally proposed, the backlash there would be people like me recommending that nobody goes to Hawaii at all unless they bring their lawyer.
Yeah, I mean, some of the comments I've gotten on this story are, okay, so, if you sneeze over there, you can sue anybody. I mean, anybody who writes anything about Hawaii could be sued, theoretically under this law. I understand that the law as it was originally envisioned was they concede it was too broad. There's some talk that if they revive it, it's going to be much more narrow language, against specific guidebooks, maybe who recommend specific places like Queen's Bath. Andrew Doughty says he is going to take Kipu Falls. Now, I don't know if you've ever been to Kipu Falls. Have you been to that one?
No, I've been to Queen's Bath, but not the other one, no.
Okay, Kipu Falls is actually not that far from the main airport when you land in Kauai, and it's actually on private. This is actually interesting. This is on private property, and the guidebooks have been saying go through, and some have actually said ignore the no trespassing signs. You have to hike about a half mile through sugarcane fields, and you get to the stunningly beautiful waterfalls on a river. And people have died in just as great a numbers there because you jump 20 feet off the rocks. There's whirlpools at the bottom. Tragically, there was a father who drowned in the while his 12-year-old son was watching just a few months ago.
Once you say ignore the no trespassing signs, any lawyer is going to tell you have a liability festival happening.
Yeah. Well, exactly. In fact, that's why I talked to another property. There's some private property over by Queen's Bath. And I said, why don't you have no trespassing signs here? And that's exactly what they said. If we put it up, not only will it be taken down, but we could be held liable. And so there's actually a small private easement, public easement that lets people go down to Queen's Bath. And it's a problem. Kauai is beautiful. And when you're a tourist, you want to go places where other people haven't been. And unfortunately, the day I was there, there was just people streaming down there. And it was a high surf advisory. And I went down, I talked to a family that was perched on a ledge at Queen's Bath. They were from Colorado. And I was talking to them about the dangers, and they said, we're being careful. 30 minutes later, when I'd come back and they were gone, there was a giant wave that just hit where they'd been. It was all wet.
Wow. And you know what? They're now suing you because you even talked to them. Hey,
exactly.
Jim Carlton from the Wall Street Journal, I promise you there'll be no litigation following this appearance on my show today. I promise you.
I hope not, Peter.
Hey, thanks again. What a great story, man. I'm going to be following that one because, as a writer myself, I go on the radio all the time and I tell people what to do. Go ahead, sue me, see if I care. We'll be back with more from Ashford Castle in Ireland. I do recommend this place, though. Back with more from Peter Greenberg Worldwide in Ireland right after this.
The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now, so call us at 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
MedJet Assist. If you're injured or hospitalized while traveling, MedJet Assist will arrange medical transportation directly to the hospital of your choice. Travel safely and be smart. Get MedJet Assist. Take trips, not chances.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
18 minutes after the hour, coming to you from Ashford Castle in Ireland. A magnificent day on this Easter weekend. I hope you're having a great time wherever you happen to be. We're taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888 888-PETER. If you can't get through on the phones, you know the drill. Email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Judy on the phone from Studio City, California. Hey, Judy.
Hello, Peter. Good morning or good day, whatever time it is where you are.
Okay, well, good afternoon and good evening to you. How can I help you?
My question is, well, my husband Tony and I were lucky enough to attend your presentation in Pasadena at the speaker series.
Oh, well, great.
You made, at that time, you made a very strong recommendation to send our luggage ahead to avoid all the airport hassle. So the problem is we are attending, we're booked on a cruise this summer out of Rome. And I contacted both UPS and FedEx, giving them the dimensions of the luggage. And
sure. Judy, let me stop you right there because you didn't hear my entire presentation that night. I said you always ship your luggage ahead of time for domestic travel, never overseas because it's outrageously expensive.
Yes, that's exactly what I found out. Exactly.
Okay. And in fact, what you really should be doing if you're going out of Rome, you know that you're going to be sailing out of a place called Civitavecchia. And which is the port city of Rome. It's about an hour and a half outside of Rome. My advice to you is, whatever day the ship is leaving, you show up in Rome 2 days early at least. That means that if the airline even loses your bag for a day, you'll still be able to get your bag before the ship leaves.
Good.
And you'll be more acclimated to get on the ship. So many people who take cruises, Judy, will actually try to get to the ship or get to that city on the same day the ship is leaving, and you know what? All breaks loose. Either their plane is late, or their bags don't show up, or both. So in this situation, no, you're going to have to check your bags, but you should go at least a day or two early.
That's exactly what we're doing. Can I ask you one other question?
Yeah, sure.
We are trying to decide what the best way is on this cruise. We want to avoid the ship's shore excursions.
Sure.
And take our own, there are four of us traveling, so we want to take, you know, private tours.
That's easy. That's very easy to do. What you do is you know the cities that you're going to, you know the ports where the ship is coming in. You can very easily research the top hotels in each of those cities, and you can go online to get their phone numbers, and then you're actually going to have a conversation, oh my God, a real conversation with a real person by calling those hotels and asking to speak to the concierge at those hotels. Let them know that you'll be arriving at the port city at a certain time, and can the hotel hire a car and driver for you that can take four people, so a total of five people, including the driver. And between the five of you, actually between the four of you who are paying for it, the cost will not be excessive. You'll get to go where you want to go at your own schedule. The only advice I give you, Judy, is make sure you get back to the ship at least 2 hours before the ship is scheduled to sail, because if you miss it on a private hire car, you've literally missed the boat, and you'll be financially responsible to get yourself to the next port of call, which means flying, okay?
I see. Okay. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Judy. We really appreciate the call. And joining us now, someone who's been on the show before, we love talking to him, especially on the eve of the royal wedding. He's the publisher and basically the originator of the Hideaway Report. His name, Andrew Harper. Hey, Andrew.
Hello, Peter. How are you? Nice to talk to you again.
And I hope you've been able to control all your excitement and enthusiasm for the wedding.
I've been doing my best.
I know.
Central America, so it's 95 degrees outside, and I saw some howler monkeys this morning and a toucan, so it's a long way from Westminster Abbey, but I'm doing my best to get in the spirit.
Well, you know what? I think you're doing the right thing by staying as far away as you can. Not that London is going to be crazy for it. My initial information is that a lot of the hotels in London, by the way, are not full and will not be full for the wedding. A lot of people aren't coming over for it. A lot of Brits are actually, like, you know, maybe some of your fellow friends are leaving town during it. And yet, the real fascination now is not the guest list, which the palace released today, but where the honeymoon destination might be. Where do you think they might go?
Well, I've seen a lot of speculation, as I'm sure you have too. Obviously, Charles and Diana went to the Greek islands on the royal yacht, but I don't think they'll be doing that because it's far too early in the year in the Mediterranean, really. People think the Mediterranean warms up, you know, by May, but it doesn't really. The sea gets nice down there in June. So I don't think they'll be going there. I think I've also seen people speculate because of the economic circumstances of the times, they might want to do a British honeymoon. But again, I can't see them up in Scotland or down in the Scilly Islands off Cornwall because, again, the climate would not be really very pleasant in May. And the Scilly Islands are lovely in July and August, but this time in May, I don't think so. And in fact, I think climate is one of the things that, you know, people really haven't factored into all of this, because I've seen people speculating about places that just are ruled out by the time of year. For example, William spent some time before he went to college in Chile, but it's winter in Chile in May, so they're not going to go to freeze in Patagonia. And, you know, the weather is, you would know yourself only too well, is pretty nasty in places like India and Thailand and all those kind of places in at that time of the year. So,
all right, so Andrew, you know what I think? I think they're going to go to Disney World.
I think the other thing that people haven't really got to think about is the image that they're trying to portray, because they're very clearly, the royal family are trying to reestablish themselves as a sober and reliable kind of institution, which they obviously hated the celebrity and the glamour side of surrounding Diana and the sensationalism of her death and so on. So I think that's the two things that are. Climate is important. Where will be nice weather? I think where will fit well with a British public, which means it doesn't have to be too glitzy, too Hollywoody, too much film star. You know, places in the Pacific like Wakaya Club or La Vala, those kind of very fancy private islands in the Pacific. They're just too glamorous, I suspect, for this. But then again, the other thing that's clearly very important for them is security, and that's why you do get back to things like yachts and private islands, or at least small camps in very remote places where they can be protected, both from the paparazzi and, obviously, you know, from people who actually like to take a shot at them. So I rather think there's a couple of same places that I think might be a factor. I mean, it's the right time of year for southern Africa. It's not the right time of year, really, for Kenya, where William proposed at Lewa Downs, which is a private estate in northern Kenya. So I can't see them going back there. It's the rainy season. But South Africa would work. Namibia, Botswana would be very nice. There's a wonderful little four-bedroom, four-tented camp in Silinda, which is an area of Botswana near the Okavango Delta, owned by a very famous wildlife photographer and filmmaking couple called Derek and Beverly Joubert, called Zarafa Camp. That would be pretty wonderful. And I think if they went down to the south of Africa, they could also possibly be engaged in some kind of charitable part of the trip or some socially benevolent kind of part of the trip, which, again, would be good for the image. If it wasn't there, then, you know, private islands, there's North Island in the Seychelles, it's particularly beautiful. There's a lovely tiny little micro dot in the Seychelles called Cuisine Island, which just has four villas. They could take the whole island. You could only get to it by helicopter. That would work. You know, you've got places like Necker Island in the Caribbean, I suppose, Richard Branson's island, and that's perhaps a bit predictable.
I wouldn't go for Necker Island, Andrew, because that's where Princess Diana liked to go. I'll tell you choices, and I may be wrong. I would say either Moustique or Jordan.
You know, Jordan's a possibility because of the friendship they have with the Jordanian royal family. That I haven't actually thought of that myself. You could well be right. Of course, the Middle East is a little troubled at the moment. But the other, I would bet against Moustique, actually, because it was so much associated with the Queen's younger sister, Princess Margaret, who had a reputation as, you know, a bit of a partier. And also, Mick Jagger has a house on Moustique. So again, it's a little racy, probably, for the image they're trying to portray. The other place, I think, I mean, the weather which might be it's pure speculation, but I wonder whether they might go to the Barrier Reef in Australia, because up on the north of the Barrier Reef, up near Cairns, it's very nice this time of year. The climate's, you know, it's the time of year you go diving on the Barrier Reef, and they might go somewhere like Lizard Island, which I'm sure you've been to, Peter.
Exactly, and you know, that might just be the ticket, but I'm still leaning towards Jordan. I may be wrong.
You've obviously got some private information which you're not sharing with us.
I wish I did.
But don't you think the current upheavals in the Middle East would be a factor against that?
Actually, I'm looking at a completely contrarian way. I think if they do Jordan now, it might have a calming effect.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as you say, there is a family connection between the Jordanian royal family, so it's certainly possible, and it's a beautiful country, and it's a nice time of year to be in that part of the world.
But, it is.
Yeah.
All right. Andrew Harper with all of our prognostications, and probably you and I will both be proven wrong. They're going to go to Brooklyn, New York. Hey, thanks for calling in from the middle of Central America. Andrew Harper from the Hideaway Report. We really appreciate that. Back with more from Ashford Castle in Ireland right after this.
To participate in the program and speak with Peter Greenberg, call 1-888-887-3837 or visit petergreenberg.com. The Peter Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now. So call us at 1-888-887-3837. That's 1-888-88-PETER. Once again, here's your host, Peter Greenberg.
It's 33 minutes after the hour. Peter Greenberg here with you from Ashford Castle on the Kong River in, depending on who you talk to, either County Mayo or County Galway. It depends on how fast you can straddle the river, I suppose. Taking your calls at 888-887-3837. That's 888-88-PETER. When you think about the history, and the history here goes back to 1228, just a few years, and you also think about, you know, the way things were built then and then added on. I remember staying at a hotel not long ago in Limerick called the Dunraven Arms, and I could never find my room because they kept on adding on to all these buildings over the years where it was just like a maze. Here at the Ashford Castle, which has about 83 rooms and a number of suites, they told me I was in room 423. And in order to get to room 423, you have to go up and then down, and then up, and then down, and around, and then you get there. And so you really, short of leaving breadcrumbs on the floor to figure out your way around, it's really quite charming. And joining me now, who understands the history of all of this, is Mick May. Mick, when you go back 1228, it's amazing that any of this is still standing, isn't it?
Well, the history going back to 1228 is a bit sketchy, a little bit sketchy. We do know that the first people who were here, they were Normans. The Normans were people who came from Northern Europe into Normandy and France, and they came over to Ireland and England and acquired by force. They acquired properties over here, and those are the people who built the big stout stone-built castles to protect themselves from the people from whom they had taken the land.
But what is unique to this particular castle? What makes this castle so special?
I suppose looking at it nowadays was the fact that it has the way it has been added to over the years, as you said there. It started small and has been added to ever since. In fact, the latest edition was as late as the 1970s, when it was there was a piece added to it by John A. Mulcahy, an Irish-American who had become a millionaire, had left Ireland as a young lad. He came over and he extended the castle.
So that's what they just kept on adding?
Yeah, they just kept adding to it.
And yet, when somebody tells me I'm in Kong, I went to Kong. It's a small place.
It is indeed. I suppose Kong, when you talk about Kong, people associate it immediately with Ashford Castle. Ashford Castle is probably the place that has made Kong famous, I would think.
But I thought Kong was more associated with the movie The Quiet Man.
Yes, indeed. The Quiet Man has strong connections with Kong. In fact, I was there when they made The Quiet Man.
Remember it? Now you're dating yourself.
I am indeed. And I don't know if I should tell you that there are three ways, you know, when you're getting old.
Go ahead.
No, the first one is you start forgetting things. Can't remember the other two.
I knew you were going there. Actually, can I give you my definition of old age?
Why not?
It's when you stop going places.
Very good.
Are we still going places? No, we're still going.
We're still going.
But The Quiet Man was a John Ford movie.
Indeed it was. Well, the reason it was made here, I believe, was John Ford. That was his stage name. John Ford was actually, his name was Feeney. And Feeney's family had left a place called Spiddle in the west of Ireland when they were young. And Feeney was very friendly with a man by the name of Lord Killannon, who lived in Spiddle. Lord Killannon was a very well-known man. He was involved with the Olympic Games at one stage. And he had kept in contact with John Ford. John Feeney was his correct name. And John Ford was always anxious to make a movie in Ireland. And when he was ready to go ahead with it, he was interrupted by the Second World War. But after the Second World War, he contacted his friend in Ireland and he asked him to get a suitable location for making a movie, with particular reference to the countryside, but more importantly, adjacent to a hotel which would be big enough to accommodate the whole crew in the making of the movie.
And that's how it happened.
And that's how it happened. That's how the movie came to call.
Isn't it a coincidence that if you stay at Ashford Castle, if you're looking to have a movie to watch in your room, they make available The Quiet Man?
Absolutely. Any time of day or night, you can have a look at it. People never get tired of looking at it. I've seen it about 50 times. I think I have the whole vocabulary of the thing off by heart by now.
Oh, my God. But then, of course, you also have the history here of the Prince of Wales going back to 1905.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, well, it is true.
Yeah. Well, yes, the Prince of Wales, who later became, as you know, became the King George V of England.
That's
he
right.
came here on a shooting. It was a fantastic shooting area, this day. Shooting was the big thing in those
days.
But
the best thing about this area, and you and I were just talking about this off air, is the ability to walk it. The ability to just get out and see it up close and personal, not in a tour bus, not with it. You can just, it's right in front of you.
Absolutely, absolutely. And a walk through the woods here is a fine pastime. But interestingly enough, when the Guinnesses came here, the place was completely bare of trees. There wasn't a tree in the place.
How'd that happen?
Well, during the time we were under the English rule, the English felled our beautiful oak forests and brought them to England mainly for shipbuilding, pit props and all
those
that type
of thing. Damn English.
Yes, there have been a bit of a problem in Ireland for quite a number of years, all right.
Mick May said this. I got it. All right. Mick, Mick May. Wonderful history of the Ashford Castle. Please, take him at his word. Get out there and walk. It is unbelievable when you come here, and you'll even sleep better as well. Thank you for joining us. I really appreciate that.
Not at all. You're very welcome.
And when we come back, we're going to go from history to archaeology with our good friend, Mr. Michael, when he comes back, right from this message after this.
Call now to talk to Peter Greenberg at 1-888-887-3837 or email him at peter@petergreenberg.com. This segment of Peter Greenberg Worldwide is proudly brought to you by
Travel Guard Insurance. For travel insurance plans for the unexpected, see your travel agent or visit TravelGuard.com for affordable travel insurance protection from Travel Guard.
Now back to Peter Greenberg.
Yeah, it's about 43 minutes after the hour here in the beautiful Ashford Castle in County Mayo or County Galway, depending on who you want to believe. 888-887-3837 is our number. That's 888-88-PETER. You know, we were just talking to Mick May about the whole idea of just getting out and walking around, but I would be remiss if I didn't give a shout-out to Desmond Leonard, who has been driving me around and to let me see all the things I need to see. And part of driving around with Desmond is it's not, you know, just pointing things out. It's telling the story. Irish drivers are usually phenomenal, if they're really good drivers, storytellers. And so a big shout-out to Desmond for being a good storyteller, not to mention a good driver because I'm alive. No, he's great. The person laughing is Michael Gibbons, who's our field archaeologist who knows Western Ireland better than anybody. When we were talking earlier in the show, Michael, we were talking about, you know, obviously the history and the buildings, but this is Joyce country, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Duke of Huia in Irish, they were the Gaelicized Norman families that came. And then they abandoned their Norman civility and adopted Irish language and culture for centuries. So they became part of the wild, barbarous Irish for a few centuries. And they gave their name to this wonderful mountainous region immediately to our west here, a couple of miles out the road.
And, of course, as we said earlier in the show, there are mountains here.
Yeah, we have about 50 small mountains, the highest just under 1,000 metres just to the west of us. A wonderful country for hiking and walking, just a tremendous place.
And then Oscar Wilde's mother...
Yeah, Oscar Wilde's parents had a home here, mature house, just across, about a mile across from Ashford. And Francesca Wilde, her family were steeped in the oral history here. And Wilde himself, William Wilde, who later became Sir William Wilde for his work on the famine reports, he wrote a wonderful book on Wilde's Loch Carrob and, of course, on the Wilde's Boyne, a fantastic account of Newgrange in the Boyne Valley, a wonderful place to visit.
Isn't it interesting that, you know, if you go back in just relatively recent American history, President Kennedy had to come to Ireland. You had Ronald Reagan staying right here at Ashford
That's right.
Castle. You have Obama coming over in the next week or two. I mean, it's unusual, isn't it?
Well, if you think the last great flight of the Celts was the millions of starving, impoverished Irish leaving here without a word of English, and they became the sort of the great American dream. They were at the bottom of the heap. My own ancestors went out, 14 of them, to Butte, Montana, to the mines.
They went to Montana?
They went to my grandfather.
You know, when you hear of the Irish immigration, you never hear of Montana.
Oh, yeah, loads of them. Mickey McGowan up into the Yukon, right up to Dawson City. Loads went out to the west. They ended up in the south. They fought in the southern armies during the American Civil War. So they were reared for export. That's what this area was for a long... So very strong ties here with North America, going back, generational ties.
So what you're saying, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that you had a period of time, actually a long period of time, where there really wasn't population growth here. It was population shrinkage.
Collapse, yeah. The only country in Europe that had a continuous population fall from 1850s down to 1970, literally massive continuous decline. 1845, we had 8.5 million, half of England. Today, after rising for 30 years, Ireland has a population of 6 million.
Wow. And I might add, because of your economy having its implosion recently, that is a great opportunity for people who are traveling because Ireland's on sale.
Oh, yeah, great, great time to come, wonderful place to stay. And we fell off a cliff there. We got on the first rung of the ladder, and then we dived off at the first chance we got. But we'll crawl back up again.
With possibly this hotel being an exception, hundreds of hotels in Ireland are now owned by banks.
Yeah,
it's almost foreclosure time.
That's right. The whole country, you know, it's like the communists have taken over. They own the whole place. So it's this is a wonderful place here because I suppose you've got, it's just steeped in every aspect of Irish history, political, social, religious, Conga Féin.
And yet the point is, it's a buyer's market now.
Yeah, lovely place. Great time to come to Ireland. Absolutely brilliant.
And for those people like me who have a particular interest in living in great places, Ireland has a unique tax law if you're a writer or an artist.
Yeah, our late, now discredited, Charlie Haw, who introduced whales, sanctuaries to Ireland, so lots of whales are now coming to Ireland. Probably always were, but we know about them now. He also introduced tax, it's a sanctuary for artists and musicians. So very interesting, all sorts of creative people either are fetched up or blown in or live here. And for Irish artists, they don't have to pay any tax. So it was a very far-sighted, intelligent sort of move. And so the creative spirit that lots of Irish people have is encouraged. So it's one of his major legacies, though the rest of his legacy is pretty dodgy.
And yet I'd like to claim right now here on the air that I'm an artist. Can I do that?
Oh, yes, you can. You don't have to pay any tax if you get a little file from the Irish Revenue Commissioners. No problem at all.
And that's it. I'm an artist.
Well, you have to show your printed books and your write and so on.
Okay, I got half that battle won. All right, Michael Gibbons, our field archaeologist and resident historian on this show, at least today. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And when we come back, we're going to be joined by a longtime resident of the Cong County, Cong and County Mayo, I should say, with a little musical. You'll see. You'll hear.
Greenberg Worldwide phone lines are open now, so call us at 1-888-88-PETER. That's 1-888-887-3837. To participate in the program and speak with Peter Greenberg, call 1-888-887-3837 or visit petergreenberg.com. Now back to Peter Greenberg Worldwide.
52 minutes after the hour here from Ashford Castle in Cong in County Mayo. And, you know, I always want to ask the locals because I don't want to see the brochure. I don't want to read the guidebook. I want to talk to somebody who actually lives here. My next guest was born and raised about 10 minutes from here. He's lived here all his life, except for one summer in London that he didn't like. He's been here his whole life. And he's not just a local, but he, when they did the movie, that John Ford movie, The Quiet Man, with John Wayne and Maureen O'Hara, guess what? He was in the movie, too. Just saw a picture of him in there, looking young and dapper. And not only that, he plays the accordion, otherwise known here as the squeeze box. And I should say that in all of my time in Scotland, I never got to a pub without an accordion. And now I've got an accordion here in Ireland. And his name, of course, Martin Noon. Hello, Martin.
Hello, sir. How are you?
So it was fun here growing up. You like?
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
What about Cong is special to you?
Well, to me, there's no place like Cong or the surrounding areas. There's no place in Ireland.
But what makes it different? What makes it special?
Well, you have where I live, I can see the mountains from the back door. And if I come anywhere near the lake is only 5 minutes away. I have land with 100 yards from the lake.
Not bad.
Yeah.
So you're surrounded by great views.
Yeah.
And to me, it's the air. I love the air.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's plenty of fresh air.
Can I ask you an indelicate question? How old are you?
Gone 80 years.
Wow, you look great. You look great.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Now, I see you brought the accordion.
Yeah.
Are you going to play something for me?
I will, yeah.
I'm ready. Go ahead. Yeah. I'm ready. Right. What are you going to play? Is this like an Irish jig?
A jig, yeah.
Okay. Shelley, our producer, is actually applauding. She never applauds.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Now, you learned to play at what age?
Pardon?
What age did you learn how to play the accordion?
About that height.
About that age, huh?
Four years, I was.
Really?
Yeah.
So you've been playing all your life?
Playing all my life, yeah.
And how old is that actual instrument you're holding right now?
It's not that old. It's about 10 years old.
Oh, it's a mere child.
Yeah, that's all. Yeah.
Now, you also sing, don't you?
I do, yeah. I sing a few songs.
Yeah,
I go out on the boat here. The boat goes out on the lake in the summertime.
I was out on that boat earlier today. It's fascinating to be out there on the lake. It's great.
But it
wouldn't have been half as fun because you weren't there.
Yeah, well, I do July, August, and September.
I better come back.
Yeah. You'll be always welcome.
Now, do you have a song you'd like to sing?
Yeah.
What song is that?
Galway Bay.
Well, let's hear it.
Oh, it may be someday you'll go back to Ireland. If it's only at the closing of your day, or to sit and watch the moon rise over Clada, or see the sun go down on Galway Bay. Just to see again the ripple on the trout stream, the women in the meadows making hay, or to sit beside a turf fire in a cabin and watch the barefoot gossums at their play. Oh, the breezes blown o'er the seas from Ireland, their perfume by the heather as they blow, and the women in the uplands digging praties speak a language that the strangers do not know. Yet the strangers come, they try to teach us their ways, they scorn us for being what we are, but they might as well go chasing after moonbeams or light a penny candle from a star. And if there's going to be a life hereafter, as somehow I feel sure there's going to be, I will ask my God to let me make my heaven in that dear land across the Irish Sea.
That was great. Martin Noon, you did this exactly on time. You know why? You hear that music? That means we're out of time.
Out of time.
Martin, and that was the best way to close this show. I really appreciate both the accordion playing and the singing. That music means we're out of time for the whole show. Got a lot of people to thank. John Calabro doing the boards in New York. Jim Wright, who got the unfortunate task of working with me right here in Ireland. Thank you, Jim. Shelley Goncharowski, our producer, the irrepressible and wonderful Paula Carroll. Of course, Des Leonard, who's going to be driving us out of here. And, of course, all the folks here at the Ashford Castle. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week, and happy royal wedding.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Visit our website at www.petergreenberg.com.